Hi, this is Hugh Cornwell, and welcome to this Mr. DeMille FM podcast. If you have any comments, suggestions, or simply want to get in touch, then please email info@mrdemillefm.com. This program is an interview with Vanessa Harryhausen, daughter of Ray Harryhausen, animation colossus, and Alan Friswell, his model restorer. I hope you enjoy the show. Well, it's my great pleasure today to be sitting here with Vanessa Harryhausen, the daughter of the powerhouse of animation in cinema, Ray Harryhausen, who passed away a few years ago. And Vanessa has founded the foundation for Ray's work. And at the moment, there's an exhibition on in Edinburgh. To celebrate his lifetime of work. So welcome, Vanessa. Thank you so much for the time to sit down.
My pleasure, utter pleasure, thank you.
Yeah, and what I'm interested to know about is you were in a complete unique place to witness the later part of your father's body of work.
Yes.
So you were born in England, right?
Correct, yes.
In London?
Yes.
And whereabouts in London did you guys live?
First of all, it was Cadogan Square behind... Oh, yeah. Harrods.
Yes.
And then we moved to just off High Street, Kensington, to Holland Park, around that area.
Right.
Ilchester Place.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And he used to have a studio in London in Shepherd's Bush, didn't he?
A while back, I remember he used to go up there by bus and go and work. Yeah.
Go in every day on the bus. That's great. Now, I mean, your father was a Native American born in Los Angeles, right?
That's correct, yes.
And his father was, his father who helped him with building some of the earlier models that he made. What was his profession, his father?
He was, I think he was a trained engineer, sort of mechanic.
Okay.
He did a lot of the props for Dad.
Yes.
And he also, I think, we have a connection with Laurel and Hardy because he did some of the technical stuff
did
in some
really?
Of the scenes for the cars. I can't remember the names of the two films at the moment offhand, but he organized the cars and the films to sort of split in half.
Oh, I see. I remember. I've seen that
film.
Yeah.
Sorry,
so he was in the film business anyway, his father?
Well, I suppose not really. He just was more on the technical side.
But, oh, I see. Yeah. And was brought in to advise on stuff.
Yeah.
Interesting.
On a mountain in Virginia stands a lonesome pine. Just below is the cabin home of a little girl of mine. Her name is June, and very, very soon she'll belong to me. For I know she's waiting there for me neath that lone pine tree. In the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia, on the trail of the lonesome pine, in the pale moonshine, our hearts entwine, where she carved her name, and I carved mine, June, just like the mountains are blue, like the pine, I am lonesome for you. In the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia, on the trail of the lonesome pine.
In the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia, on the trail of the lonesome pine. In the pale moonshine, our hearts entwine, where she carved her name and I carved mine, oh June. Like the mountains, I'm blue, like the pine, I am lonesome for you.
In the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia, on the trail of the lonesome pine,
Now, Ray moved to England with Charles Schneer, his producer, to make The Three Worlds of Gulliver, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that was the first film made in England. When he moved, were his parents still alive, your grandparents?
My grandfather passed away when I was born in 1964.
Okay.
And my granny was still alive and lived in Los Angeles.
So they stayed in LA?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah,
prior to the move to England, he was literally living with his parents and making things in the garage.
In the garage, yeah, yeah. I mean, really, if you think about it, during that time, you know, it was just after or during the Depression. And, you know, for parents to believe that your son has this wonderful idea because he went and saw a movie, which was King Kong, that set it all off.
When he was 13 years old, I believe.
I know, yeah. And he went and saw it, I don't know, 100 times or more. I can't remember. But,
and that was his big inspiration,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. And for his parents, I guess when he came back seeing the movie, he must have ranted and raved. And
they thought, we're onto something here.
Well, yeah, but, you know, I guess in those days, it's sort of like putting your daughter or son on the stage. It just wasn't a done thing. It was very risky. So to have that faith, to know that your son could possibly do that, I think that's tremendous.
And support him struggles.
Yeah, so they set up a wee studio in the garage.
Oh, I see.
And Grandpa and Grandma helped and so supported and slowly, you know, got him through the things.
Yeah, that's remarkable. I know he attended the, Centre for Arts in LA and studied for a few years.
He went to acting school, he went to night school, and then in his early teens, I think he was in the army doing stuff too. So
and he worked with the Colonel Frank Capra.
Frank Capra
was his film unit, wasn't it?
He was
in the film unit, that's right. So he came out of the war, and he'd retrieved some undeveloped film, hadn't he, from his time in the army, and made some of his own little films as like demo tapes.
Yeah, there's a lovely one in the exhibition here that I just get so excited about because somebody said that they had found a clip of film that I think actually, I don't know whether he made it in his garden or what, but it's one of his early dinosaurs.
Yeah.
And I think it's just made out of cloth and it's quite chunky. But oh my gosh, when you see it animated going, it's walking across the lawn and then you have that famous swish of the tail.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, I was so excited to see it. I was like, oh my God, is there more, you know. And the old film is quite, you know, it's quite shaky because it's so old and it's got lines across it. But it's, you know, it gives you the idea of where he's trying to go with that. And then you see the birds flying on these wires through the seed and everything. And I just love it. You know, I just thought, gosh, that's what he's trying to do. And you can just see it there. And it's, you know, it was very exciting.
Well, what he did was very captivating. I mean, you mentioned it just then. You said you wanted more. As soon as you saw a bit of animation, you wanted a bit more because you thought, oh, I like that.
Yeah, what's going to happen next?
Yes,
you know,
exactly.
It's like,
so it was a very captivating thing that he did. Now, he was very much a one-man, I think he was a one-man industry.
He was,
effects industry, because he did nearly everything by himself, didn't he?
Yeah, I think because he just found it easier that way, not to try and instruct other people, and he knew in his mind,
he
and
knew
then
what
he could
wanted.
Remember and not get any distractions. So it worked for him, and I mean, look at all the wonderful animation he's done from
it's incredible.
Hard work though, doing it on your own.
I mean, up to 2 years sometimes after the film had been shot, there was 2 years of post animation that he did by himself before the film was ready.
Yeah, and sometimes if he had a little studio somewhere, like say in Shepherd's Bush, he'd have a wee couch and he'd just take maybe an hour or two sleeping on the couch there and then carry on and
completely,
you know,
dedicated to
what
he did.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Mum was a good soul too to put up with it, but
she was almost like a sailor's wife, you know. He was always on a boat somewhere in another century. Getting on to your life growing up with him, did he have any hobbies or anything, or was this completely life-consuming for him? Did he play golf? I mean, did he have anything?
Yeah, he did try a bit of golf. He got a bit fed up of it. He said it was boring.
Well, yeah.
Knocking a ball around. He wasn't interested in really any kind of sport, like football or tennis or anything like that.
Yeah.
So he loved reading. He loved the arts. He loved film. Loved music. So I guess he just stuck to those. But June, you know, when I was a child, we used to go to Disneyland a lot and Magic Mountain and stuff. And then we used to go and visit a lot of his friends, like, you know, Ray Bradbury.
Yes, yeah.
They live just sort of the other side of Hollywood and that.
Yeah.
So, you know, we used to go and spend time with them and hang out and stuff. So, you know, he did have family time, and he made sure that that family time was very, very precious.
Yeah. And you visited America a lot.
Family. Christmas, any holidays, you know, I used to fly out on my own when I was wee.
And your grandparents were there?
Well, my grandmother.
Apologies.
I think sometimes he used to write scripts and stuff upstairs or do sketches, because we found some sketchbooks and stuff later on. Especially of Clash of the Titans, funny enough, we found some very early sketches of that he just shoved in a bookcase and forgot about it, you know.
What, years before the film was made?
No, years after.
I mean, but the sketches were made years before
I only found them when he asked me to go to LA and go and see if there was anything of interest in the garage.
Yeah.
I think that was the early 90s or something. And,
right.
Yeah, I went out and I came back with something like 16 boxes or whatever of stuff that he'd forgotten about, including these wonderful little maquettes and some of the things from the Mother Goose story tales, you know, things like Hansel and Gretel, you know, the wee models and that. So it was wonderful.
From his early job with George Powell, right?
Yeah. Hmm. And then we found all the furniture and, you know, and the costumes all made of Hansel and Gretel were all made by Granny. And, you know, and the sets and everything were done by Grandpa. So,
It
was a real family thing.
Yeah.
And they used to run those things for educational, for children in schools and that, for all the Mother Goose stories and that.
Yeah.
So, and it's lovely. You know, you've got Midas, you've got Rapunzel, you've got Hansel and Gretel, you've got all the little...
All the classic fairy stories.
And that's all his lovely early animation.
Yeah.
And Mother Hubbard and the little dog, you know.
Yeah.
And we found all these wonderful things. So it was like Christmas. And when I was in LA, I came across some film. There was big tubs of canisters of film, and I didn't know what to do, and I rang Daddy up and I said, what do you want me to do? He says, call Randy Cook up. So I said, okay. So Randy Cook then asked Jim Danforth, who also helped Daddy on Clash of Titans, and they came over and they helped me sort it out, because it was just growing arms and legs getting stuff out of this garage. So they were like two wee boys. They were like going, oh my god, looks at me. You know, it was so much fun looking at all the boxes, and it really was like Christmas all over. And this heat, it was so hot, it was in the sort of early summer, and we were sitting in the yard at the back of the garage and bringing all these boxes out, and we had such a blast. And they were so, so lovely. And we found some wonderful treasures. And then Daddy said, well, box up what you think we need and bring it home.
You must remember this. A kiss is still a kiss. A sigh is just a sigh. The fundamental things apply as time goes by. And when two lovers woo, they still say I love you. All that you can rely. No matter what the future brings, as time goes by. Moonlight sad and love songs are never out of date. Hearts full of passion, jealousy and hate. Woman needs man, and man must have his mate that no one can deny. It's still the same old story, a fight for love and glory, a case of do or die. The world will always welcome lovers as time goes by. And love songs are never out of date. Hearts full of passion, jealousy and hate. Woman needs man, and man must have its mate that no one can deny. It's still the same old story, a fight for love and glory, a case of do or die. The world will always welcome lovers as time goes by.
The Ray Harryhausen Foundation, which began its life from these trips to these garages and finding all these pieces, right?
I think the seed was what I understood from Daddy was that he, unfortunately, through his life, saw a lot of his friends like Forry Ackerman and other people lose their collection due to one way or the other.
Yeah.
And he didn't want it just being dispersed and people, you know, just it going to nothing. He wanted it to be educational.
Mm.
And he wanted young folk and young artists to get inspiration and learn from it. So he put this foundation together with Mummy.
Yeah.
To do that so that it could be preservation of his creatures and his artwork, and educational, so young animators could understand. I mean, now you've got so much technology.
Yeah.
And everything's done on iPhones or whatever. But,
exactly.
You know, at that time, if you wanted to go back, he wanted you to have that opportunity to see how these old things were done.
Yeah, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And it was very important because it's the young folk that inspired him. He got inspired from, you know, Willis O'Brien, who did Mighty Joe Young. He gave him a chance. And, you know, so Daddy, it was so important for Daddy to give other people inspiration in that, and
yeah.
That's why he wanted to put the foundation together to,
yeah.
to whether you be interested in animation, art, film, whatever
yeah.
You know, he just wanted to give some kind of inspiration to them, and all walks of life. With this exhibition here at Edinburgh, it's amazing, so many different people have come, and they're not all filmies, you
no.
know, and that's what I was saying to the guys here, that when we were setting it up, a lot of people just know him from films. I want them to understand the deeper
yeah.
side of him.
Well, he was an artist.
Well, the artist. I mean, he did these amazing sculptures and these beautiful
yeah.
artwork. You know, the storyboards that you've seen.
Yeah. Some of them are in the exhibition.
Yeah.
They're
yeah.
lovely.
And that was to give the directors and the actors a visual on what he had in his head of the creatures that they were supposed
yeah.
to fight.
Yeah.
You know, it's all very well coming up to you and saying, right, I want you to act and pretend you're going to kill a cyclops or you're fighting a cyclops. Well, what the hell does a cyclops look like?
Yes, exactly.
So, you know, a lot of these people have to have a visual, and because it's not there when they're acting, they need to have a vision. And so that's why he thought it was so important with the storyboards and everything.
Yeah.
And also, you know, once he made these models, they were so true to the pictures.
Yeah.
You know, I was so lucky in my life to be able to see, I remember as a child going up to Daddy's office and seeing his sketches, because he had his main desk and then to the side he had an easel. And he used to be sketching, and I remember one of them was, I think it was a golden voyage, it was a fountain of destiny that he was drawing. And then I saw him doing the griffin scene, all in this beautiful black and white pastels, colours. And then the next time I went, he'd be starting with this armature. And then before you know it, he seemed to have this griffin on the table. He had this wonderful model that had all these moving joints. And so I had that wonderful experience of seeing it.
You saw it translate.
Absolutely. And then to see it moving on the screen.
Yeah.
It was like, oh, my God, this thing's only this big, you know. It's only a hand size. And it's like 10 foot, 20 foot tall on screen, you know, running around. So it was a real, real pleasure.
So he would be involved in the script development, art direction, design, the storyboards, etc., etc., etc. So he was in effect the director of the film. But because of the Directors Guild of America, there are some strange, complicated rules which meant that he couldn't be credited as the director at the time. Is that correct?
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
So yeah. Him and Schneer, they take on like a job director and say, okay, here's the storyboards, this is the shooting script, you make it, now you do it, you make it. So, and they had to take that on, the directors had to take that on board, you know, that the project was set up for them to shoot, you know.
I mean, Dad was very, I mean, I hear from a lot of the actors, like in Jason, as one of the guys gets stomped on by Talos. And Dad apparently ran across the beach and was trying to tell him how to fall and look up. So, you know, he'd interact with them as much as he could too to get that scene and that shot
he
right.
He knew how the foot was going to come down, so he knew how to put the actor there.
So he was a real hands-on guy as well. Yeah,
totally.
And that's what everybody said, you know. Yeah. So it's lovely to hear that from the actors and the other people.
How old were you when you realised what he did for a living?
Probably Golden Voyage, because that was the first time I was on the set. Well, that's not true. Technically, I was on set for Gwanji, but I was so wee.
Yeah.
I mean, there's lovely pictures of me sitting on Dad's lap, and I used to play with the dinosaur Gwanji in that.
Yeah.
And it was just a plaything, because I know on one of the interviews that Dad had with somebody, they said, well, wasn't your daughter frightened by all these creatures? And no, they're just her playthings.
They were
like pets. Yeah, and they weren't ever frightening to me. So, you know, he let me have them as dollies. You know, I had there's a famous story of me in Harrods in a baby buggy having Guanji in the baby buggy, and two ladies come up and
they scream.
They wanted to have a look at the dolly, and I pulled back the cover, and there was Guanji snarling. You know, and
brilliant.
They told Mummy off something terrible, saying that I wouldn't be a normal child, or, you know, having creatures like that in my baby buggy, and I should have dollies instead. But you know, it's...
That's great. Yeah, I love that little story. That's great.
So, but yeah, it was all... I was very lucky. Never, ever did he ever say, don't touch, unless it was wet. And then you'd say, just look at it today.
Yeah.
Because it's just drying. Yeah. But I was allowed to open the cabinet and hold them and look at them and discuss them with him, if you know. So yeah. And then that wonderful, you know, area where if he was in his back office upstairs in his bedroom and he was making something, you know, there's a story in the book that I wrote that, you know, he had a drawer full of, this sounds macabre, a drawer full of eyeballs. So he had these little drawers, and he had all sections of different things in, and one of them had all these little doll's eyeballs in. And he'd say, well, what colour do you think we might put in here today for this one? And so, you know, it was quite nice having...
And ask your advice.
Well, not advice, but just get me involved and...
yes, great.
You know, why we thought it was those colour brown eyes or yellow eyes would be better, or green eyes, you know, for the cat or whatever. So,
so the Seventh Voyage, then you were on the set and then it really hit you what he was...
Golden Voyage.
Sorry, Golden Voyage.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, because I saw, again, I saw Carly being made and with all the arms and the... and everything, and it was just brilliant. It really was lovely.
Now, luckily enough, there's a list of his favourite films in your book, which is remarkable, because some of the choices, to me, demonstrate some of his character in some of his choices. Like, there's a Bette Davis film, Now Voyager, which is about the transformation of a spinster into a very worldly woman.
Yes.
It's almost like... the Bette Davis character is the creature of one of his films and transforms into another
wonderful
type
of
creature. Yeah. So that was an interesting choice, I thought. And then there's another, The Fountainhead, which is about the architect.
Yeah, I found that a bit heavy.
Yeah, but he was an individual.
Yeah.
He was unconventional and he was a bit of a rebel. Now, his films, I mean, they're bordering sort of on horror, but they're not really horror. Did he like horror films, like the modern genre of horror films, or did he find it all a bit too graphic?
We used to watch Frankenstein and Dracula and all that.
Yeah.
And
the more classical ones.
Yeah, the more classical ones, yeah. So I guess there is a bit of a macabre horror in his films. Because, I mean, you've got dinosaurs eating dinosaurs and people and stomping through towns and... you know, cities and that. So, yeah, there is an element of destruction and nastiness there.
And it was obviously very romantic, I think, and his sense of the macabre, and he loved adventure films, mystery films.
Yes.
And he's even got The Island of Lost Souls where Charles Laughton says that classic line, "The natives are restless tonight," and he hears the drums in the background, which is great. But one film at the top of the list, and it was the first one he wrote down, which may tell us something, was She.
Uh-huh.
So could you say that was one of his really favourite films of all time?
Yeah, he loved it. I think it was the idea of the lady walking through the internal flame and living forever.
But eternal youth.
Yes, exactly.
Thank you.
He wanted people in the cinema to be entertained and not depressed and walk out. You know, yes, you've got to believe in fantasy, and it was so important. And he loved that magical idea. And, you know, I did too. And I, you know, he believed in aliens and all sorts. You know, he used to be in his book collection. He's got a lot of things about space and aliens and all sorts of whether they visited or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, he wanted to just transfer that to the public and have them come out entertained and like, oh, wow, there is magic out there.
Yeah.
You know, because life is, you know, your everyday life is pretty hard, and sometimes it'll be a bit cruddy sometimes, you know.
You need escape.
Yeah.
People need escape.
Yeah.
I've got a great quote here, if I could, just from him. The cinema was made for fantasy rather than normal kinds of stories, mundane stories. It gives you a feeling of wonder, for one thing. It gives you stimulation of the imagination. And I think adults like fantasy as what, just as much as children. Most people feel it's rather childish to have an imagination. I don't agree with that. I think you should go through life and imagine the very best.
Absolutely, 100%. I totally agree with that. And
yeah.
You know, I've got a lot of people say to me, oh, Vanessa, you've got very lot of childlike qualities. And I'm like, well, so what? Who says, well, there's no law saying that you can't have...
Exactly.
You know, a bit of fun and
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And the other one is great. If you make things too real, it brings it down to the mundane.
Yes.
Which I think gives
absolutely
the reason
you've got
why
to have that mystery to it.
And
yeah.
That's why the hands-on animation that your father did is much more gripping than the computer-generated
yes
stuff, because the computer-generated stuff looks so real that it doesn't give any chance for the imagination to contribute.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it doesn't capture the imagination yeah so much.
But, you know, when Dad retired, he knew that there was a big swing and difference with the CGI and all
he
sorts of
it
different.
He knew was coming.
Yeah. And that was fine. He knew that, you know, you've got to accept change and you've got to go with it. But he had had it. I think he'd just got tired. And I mean, he, at the end, you know, when with Clash, he was consultant to a lot of people doing stuff and advisory
yeah
and did lectures and stuff like that,
yeah,
which he thoroughly enjoyed. But I think today, your people, young folk, it's very hard to have that patience to do one frame at a time.
Yeah.
They want everything instant.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So, you know, some people are going back to that, you know.
I've heard that.
He loved Wallace and Gromit,
yes,
of all things. You know, he had some very unexpected things that I didn't think he'd be interested in. But he
yeah
loved Wallace and Gromit, and he loved the film Lion, Rich and the Wardrobe.
Yes,
yeah. And all that. You
yeah
know, he loved that. And then he loved Avatar.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, really? You like that? And it was like, just some things, you know. And he said, yeah, I like the fantasy in that.
Now, just to bring it home to people who are listening, that how remarkably time-consuming this was, there's the famous sequence of the skeletons from Jason and the Argonauts, which is one of the classic sequences from Ray's work. And there were 35 different things to move for each frame, because each skeleton had 5 appendages, the head and the 2 arms and the 2 legs. So that's 5 things and times 7. That's 30. He had to move 35 things for every frame, and there's 24 frames per second. So sometimes he would only do half a second of film in a day. And I think that whole sequence took 4.5 months to film. A couple of minutes long.
Yeah.
So it's to our listeners, this is the kind of work we're talking about.
Complete. I know, and then you see it on screen, and it's so fluid.
Oh,
and you don't appreciate, you know, until you you've just broken it down now for the folk to understand. It's like, how do you have that patience?
Yeah.
I mean, God help you if you forgot where you were. You have to start all over again.
Now, there's a notable exception from this collection of films, which I wondered about, and that's The Thief of Baghdad, because yes. I know that he in homage to it, I think in Clash of the Titans, there's a homage to Thief of Baghdad, or one of the films, there's a homage to Thief of Baghdad, and yet it's not on this list, which is, I find that curious.
I don't know. I think the list you're talking about was for a sculptor guy called Gareth Knowles, who did a big life-size sculpture of the David Livingstone at Blantyre being attacked by a lion. And I think Dad just wrote it on the back of an envelope, and then handed it to him. So, but yeah, we used to watch Thief of Baghdad a lot, and he loved the sequence with the horse flying through the air.
It's
so I think
that film.
Yeah, that probably would be the Pegasus thing. Maybe I don't know. I'm presuming that would be.
Yeah. It's fascinating to talk to you. I could talk all day to you. With so many questions, I think we've sort of given a pretty rounded impression of what your father's work involved, and now this lovely foundation you've got now set up, which, as I said, is at the moment on exhibition in Edinburgh, mm-hmm. at the Museum of Modern Art number 2.
Yes.
And are there plans for this, once it ends in 2022, are there plans for it to go somewhere else? Because it seems a shame if it suddenly stops. It feels like it should start travelling around.
Well, initially, yes, I think we all wanted it to do. At the moment, we're just in discussions because we don't know what's going to happen with this pandemic that's still carrying on.
Yeah.
We'll just have to just wait and see. We don't want it to die. We want it to carry on, but we just have to. I'm afraid I can't say any more than that because don't know. But yeah, we'll try and do exhibitions.
Like to go elsewhere. That's great. So, and I'd just like to finish with one great quote. Yeah, when Tom Hanks was awarding Ray with a Lifetime Achievement Oscar. Uh-huh. He said that Jason the Argonauts was the greatest movie ever made. Forget Citizen Kane, which is a remark. What an amazing accolade! And apparently he stands by that and still believes it. So, and a lot of people have said, like George Lucas
and Peter Jackson.
Scorsese. Lots of people have said that if it hadn't been for Ray Harryhausen, they wouldn't have. They wouldn't have gone into the film business. They owe him everything for the inspiration and the way in which he propelled them to say, I want to do this as well in some form. Yeah. So, Vanessa, thank you very much for sparing the time to talk to me. I urge anyone who can, who's got the opportunity, to go and see the exhibition in Edinburgh. It's fantastic.
It's also online.
And
I just wanted to just say thank you to everybody who's listening and all Dad's fans out there, whether you be moviegoers, artists, sculptors or whatever. Thank you for keeping my father's memory alive, and he would be most humbled by all your, you know, wonderful comments through the years and coming to see this exhibition. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Vanessa. Thank you. And now I'm speaking with Alan Friswell, who, could I say you're the chief conservator for the Harryhausen Foundation, or the only conservator?
I think that would be fair to say, yes.
So now your job is to sort of renovate and repair all Ray's artifacts from his life, yeah?
Yes, and what an amazing privilege it is to be allowed to do it.
Yeah.
It really is, it really is.
And how did you come to be in this position? Have you got a speciality?
Well, working special effects, I've done it since I was 18 years old. And the way that I got to work for Ray had a website back in 2019 when he was 89. And there was a posting on there saying that some of the models, like Carly, Talos, Guanji in particular, were in such a bad state of repair that they needed to initiate a program of restoration, because various galleries and exhibitions were asking for the models to go into exhibits, but they couldn't be touched. And so in 2010, they were going to start, as I say, a program of restoration. And I didn't know. I assumed they might have had someone to do this. But these are these moments when you have to do stuff. You have to try. So I sent an email immediately saying, I know how to do this. I've done this all my life. This
assuming you were going to get a no, it's okay, we found somebody.
I automatically assumed that if they got back to me at all, they'd be saying, well, thank you, but no thanks. We've got it covered. And they got back to me in 10 minutes. And to my amazement, they said Ray knew who I was. That was seriously crazy. I really didn't expect that. And they said, well, would I be pleased to speak about this with the foundation? And it didn't take very long for me to answer. I said, yes, absolutely I would. And so it went quiet for a little while. I met up with the foundation and spoke to them about this. And I say Ray was interested in what I was doing. He knew who I was. And it wasn't until 2010, Ray was 90. It was just after his birthday. And I was asked to go to Ray's house, which was kind of brilliant but terrifying, slightly terrifying. First of all, I'd met him before, but very, very fleetingly. But this was a real sit-down meeting with him, and it was incredible. And
Where had you met him before?
Oh, I'd met him at conventions. I'd met him specifically at a convention. I wrote a letter to him when I was 11, and my parents said, like, you know, he's a very busy man. It's very unlikely he's going to get back, not because he's ignorant of you, but because he's obviously getting fan letters all the time. And in 2 weeks, I'd put my phone number in, hopefully. And 2 weeks later, I got a phone call from his wife, Diana. And I'd put a couple of dinosaur pictures in with the letter. And she phoned me and said, Ray liked your pictures, and if you want to phone him the next week — he was in America at the time — she said, if you want to phone him next week. And she gave me the phone number. So I was 11 years old, and I was terrified, absolutely terrified. I didn't know what to say to him. What could I say to him? And my mum kind of goaded me into it. She said, you're not going to do it. You're not going to do it. And she got me kind of so riled up. I thought, right, I'm going to do it. And I stormed out into the hallway, and I phoned him. And he spoke to me for about 25 minutes, half an hour. And I didn't know what to say, but he was so warm, he was so accommodating
and supportive and everything.
I told him what I wanted to do, and he was so, like, encouraging. He said, and I remember him saying, it was like incredible. I've said this to so many people. He said, and I was 11 years old, so I couldn't believe I was hearing this. He said, always be ready to make mistakes, always be ready to get it wrong, because that's the nature. He said, never be ready to give up. He said, because that's not what it's about. He said, it's what it's about is having a dream and doing everything you can to make it come true. And he said that to me when I was 11 years old.
There's a bit of synchronicity here, because when he was, after he'd seen King Kong when he was 13, and then, you know, he got in touch with
Willis O'Brien.
That's right, as a young man, and ended up
working on Mighty Joe Young with him. Yeah,
I know. Yeah. So there's a bit of synchronicity here.
I think what happened, Ray was so grateful for that experience
exactly.
when he was younger, and
he
realised that
it on.
If not for that, I'm saying he would certainly have done something in his life. But Willis O'Brien was very supportive and very encouraging to him. And so I know these stories from many other people that I know, people who are worked on Star Wars, Jurassic Park, Indiana Jones, Ghostbusters, RoboCop. They said Ray said the same thing to them when they were kids, and he was so he realised he was passing it on, and he certainly did that to me.
He touched a lot of people in his 90 years, definitely.
Well, there's a wonderful Mike Henkin, who's kind of like technically the biographer of Ray, has written these wonderful books called The Master of the Magics, three wonderful books. And he put a thing, he's like, rewritten some of this stuff to add new material. One of the things he said was very, very telling, and it's absolutely correct. He said that Ray was like a real-life George Bailey, the character that Jimmy Stewart played in It's a Wonderful Life, that through his life he touched so many other people's lives in such a positive way and created so much cause and effect. So many things that had Ray not been there would not have happened. And so Ray simply living his life how he wanted and doing the things he wanted. But it was such a positive and wonderful thing that he did. And so, yes, absolutely, Ray is a catalyst for so many other people. That's so many things that have happened since.
Good word for it, a catalyst.
Buffalo gal, would you come out tonight? Come out tonight, come out tonight. Buffalo gal, would you come out tonight? Dance for the light of the moon. As I was walking down the street, down the street, down the street, pretty little girl I chanced to meet under the silvery moon.
Buffalo gal, would you come out tonight? Come out tonight, come out tonight. Buffalo gal, would you come out tonight? Dance for the light of the moon.
My wife and I'd be happy all my life. Skip to Maloo, my darling.
Buffalo girls, won't you come out tonight? Come out tonight, come out tonight. Buffalo girls, won't you come out tonight? Dance for the light of the moon.
Dance with a gal with a hole in the stocking, and a heel kept a rockin', and a heel kept a rockin', and a buffalo gal, won't you come out tonight? Dance for the light of the moon.
Buffalo gal, won't you come out tonight? Come out tonight, come out tonight. Buffalo gal, won't you come out tonight? Dance for the light of the moon.
So your training in special effects, did you do any courses or anything?
Well, no, not really. I mean, I went to art college, and because it was when I left school, like my parents, I was so grateful. My parents were incredibly supportive of what I was trying to do. They were very much like working class people, and you kind of would expect they say, don't be silly, get out of school, get a job. But they didn't. They were very like encouraging, and they, looking back, I mean, they were so responsible in many ways for what I'm able to do.
And where did you go to art college?
It was in East London, in Barking Dagenham College of Technology, which was an interesting place. And I'm still very pleased to say I'm actually still in touch with some of my old tutors.
That's like, great.
One fella is 90 years old now, and he's like, you'd be interested in this. I've got to tell you, his name is Charles Front, okay? And the reason why he's 90 now, at least, or he might be 91, but he was the guy who designed the cover for the Beatles' Rubber Soul album.
Oh, really?
So he designed that. He drew the Rubber Soul
logo.
And he was one of my tutors at college.
That's incredible. Now, I understand that there's upwards about 50,000 objects that have been found from Ray's work in various locations in America and here. And how many of those are being used in this present exhibition in Edinburgh? A couple of thousand, maybe? Not even
there,
that?
There is a lot. I mean, there is so much of Ray's work. I mean, it's generally believed that outside of Walt Disney, Ray's probably got the largest private collection of film memorabilia, although obviously all related to his own work, that probably exists. I mean, it's serious because Ray never threw anything away.
Yeah.
And now we're all grateful for that.
Yeah.
We're so pleased that Ray kept it all.
But it's only a fraction that's being used in this exhibition,
It's realistically, unless you have a building the size of the Albert Hall, it's probably the only way you can do that.
Yeah.
You'd have to have a gigantic venue to put every single item on display.
Yeah.
And it would be great to do that.
And but, so now all those objects well, a lot of them, the vast majority of them, are going to need restoration, right?
Well, it's the...
Or is that not the case?
Well, no, it's possible. I mean, many of the models, a lot of the actual stop-motion models, we've got to a lot of them. I mean, I've fixed quite a lot of them. There are still some that are outstanding, and they're all the models that Ray made for his fairy tales.
Right,
which
the
was
early
before,
stuff.
Before he actually got into the movie, the film industry. He did those himself in his garage.
Yeah.
And quite a lot of those. There are so many replacement models, like for different phases of animation, you have to build a different model for certain things. And so there are dozens of these things.
Yeah.
And quite a lot of those are in need of repair. So that's something that probably will be addressed at some point in the future.
Yeah.
And lots of bits and pieces. There's lots of stuff. I mean, not much of Ray's material, drawings and sketches and all sorts of things. And those are so valuable to us. So many stills.
Yeah.
Many people haven't seen them. I mean, obviously, these are for perhaps publication at some point because there are so many treasures in there that we've discovered. Connor has done much of this because he's the as I say, the curator of the whole thing.
Yeah.
So, and Vanessa did a lot as well. She actually went through so much stuff of her dad's.
Yeah.
And it was a great experience to do that because the stuff that she'd not seen for ages, sometimes not seen at all, which was amazing to see.
I understand some of the objects were or models were, you know, if you touch them, they just fall away into they just disintegrate.
This was initially the reason why, because I was so lucky. I mean, from 2010 to 2013, I worked for Ray personally. I mean, I worked with Ray. I couldn't believe this. It was unbelievable, you know, incredible. So we had these models, like Talos was one, Carly was another. These figures, what happened? Without getting too technical, what happens is latex rubber is an organic material. It comes from a tree.
Yeah, and it decays.
So it's biodegradable.
Mm.
So what happens is you have polymer molecules with a chemical element around them, and the chemical element actually dissipates over a period of time. And the usual thing that happens is the molecules drag together and it dries out.
Mm.
Sometimes they drift apart and it becomes liquid, like sticky.
Mm.
But usually
it's the other way.
They come together and it dries out. In the case of Carly, was probably the worst example we've seen because, I mean, you couldn't get her out of a box. There's no way. I mean, to put in an exhibit would be impossible. You couldn't get her out of a box. She was like, if you imagine a model made out of an OXO cube, if you
same
touch
sort
it,
of consistency.
It would crumble.
So what on earth do you do with a situation
well,
like that?
So, The reason, probably one of the reasons, I think there are several reasons why I managed to get the position with Ray, for which I'm so grateful. But one of them, I developed a new material. I developed a new polymer acrylic compound because when I was a kid, I was kind of a bit like a mad scientist. And I used to mix things together just to see what would happen.
Yeah.
And 9 times out of 10, nothing did. It'd be useless. But now and again, you'd get some kind of weird result. And when I was much younger, I thought, well, the problem with rubber being biodegradable is the chemical that dissipates around the polymer molecules. I thought, well, if you could replace that with something that would not deteriorate, then that would be a big step forward. So I thought, well, acrylic, because acrylic is a synthetic compound, but it's very flexible and very compatible with rubber, but it doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't deteriorate. So I replaced the chemical element with an acrylic compound around the polymer molecule, so it stays together. So what I managed to do was work out 4 different variations of the formula, and one of them is very liquid. It's like water. So with Carly, what I was able to do was paint this stuff directly on, and it soaks into the rubber.
I see.
So it re-establishes all the molecular compound from within. Wow. So what was once like so crumbly you couldn't touch it, now you can pick her up by one leg and shake her around.
Almost rejuvenating compound.
And so once that was done, then I could repair all the damage.
I see.
And sculpt back in with the hardened form of the polymer that you can sculpt with.
That's fantastic. I hope you put in a patent application for some of those
that
things.
That is pending. I'm definitely, no, seriously, because I wonder what the applications for this might be,
of course.
From an industrial point of view.
Yeah. Now, going on, what would you think was the most difficult restoration that you've achieved?
Difficulty. Talos had to have his hands replaced because they were so badly damaged. Oh. There was nothing you could do.
Yeah.
And that was complicated. Probably in terms of I repaired the tiny boy from Valley of Gwangi that was carried away by the pterodactyl. That was the first one I did, and Ray gave that to me as a sample. I mean, he actually gave that to me. I couldn't believe that I was working with the man, and he was happy with that. And I thought he was going to give me something slightly more complicated. And he brought out the Allosaurus from 1 million years BC, which is 5 times the size. And the tail was missing practically, the feet were destroyed, and the left arm was gone. And he said, what about that? And I wouldn't say that was more difficult than the others, but it was the first culture shock seeing this thing. And I thought, I know I can repair it, but it was quite frightening, just for about 5 minutes. And so that it wasn't more complicated than any of the others in terms of the technicalities involved in repairing it.
Yeah.
But it was like a bit of a shock to suddenly be given that.
Yeah, one of the first things.
Yeah, in pure difficulty. I mean, they all have their own needs. I mean, the giant cephalopod from Mysterious Island, the shell was gone completely. Ray had left it in Shepton Studios back in 1961, I think.
Yeah.
So Ray asked me to build a new shell, a giant shell,
which I made
of fiberglass.
How do you say, like with Mighty Joe Young, with the fur? How do you, if you're touching an object, one of these old mannequins, and the fur's like disintegrating, what can you do about that?
Well, in case of Mighty Joe Young, it was so badly gone. What we decided was, I mean, he didn't have any fur basically. So what was needed, and I agreed completely, that to restore him completely would be taken away from the integrity of the original model. So because it was 1949 and it looked okay as it did in that state, I simply applied another part of a version of the polymer to just stop him. He won't deteriorate anymore.
Yeah.
He's frozen in time. But regarding models that do have fur that's missing, that's basically a taxidermy job, which is another discipline entirely.
Right.
So replacement of fur is to actually shave off the fur, put on layers of fur, apply it with like taxidermist glue and other materials, comb it into place. And so that's just another technique that is needed to repair these things.
Beautiful dreamer, wake unto me. Starlight and dewdrops are waiting for thee. Sounds of the rude world heard in the day, lulled by the moonlight, have all passed away. Beautiful dreamer, queen of my song, list while I woo thee with soft melody. Gone are the cares of life's busy throng. beautiful dreamer, awake unto me. Beautiful dreamer, awake unto me. My song, lest while I woo thee with soft melody, gone are the cares of life's busy thought. Beautiful dreamer, awake unto me. Beautiful dreamer, awake unto me.
And what about your favourite restoration?
Oh, that's difficult. Obviously, yeah, that's a tricky one.
Good, I'm glad it's a tricky question.
There is a tricky one. There are so many, because the thing that... The thing that's perhaps difficult to communicate is that I get these things. Connor says we're going to do this one next, because Connor decides which are going to be done next, and he puts something, get it out of the box, and each of these things have some memory for me. Like Gwangi, for God's sake, Gwangi comes out of the box, and you're granted with this incredible privilege to work, just to be sitting there with it, let alone repair it,
and being familiar with the film.
Unbelievably, yeah. Yes. And I mean, you know, he was Carly from Golden Voyage. Again, the memories of these things, and so. Favourites are difficult, but I mean, they just all kind of... The Allosaurus and Wumbling Years BC, again, that was one of my absolute favourite films. When I saw that on a re-release when I was 6 years old, and so that was really the first Ray film I ever saw. So yeah. I appreciate what a special thing that was for me.
Yeah.
It was such a special film.
Yeah.
So, as Ray used to say, it's very difficult to say which is my favourite, because the others will get jealous.
Great quote. I love that. So what do you think is your favourite Harryhausen movie?
I've got several. I mean, they're all great in their own way. They all have their own values. I think it would be, I mean, the things that had an effect on me personally in my life, Wumbling Years BC was the first film, and I saw that, lucky to see that many times on re-releases when I was about 6 or 7 years old. Anytime it was in the local newspapers, my mum and dad kind of knew somebody was going to have to take me to see this. It was a done deal. There was no way. There was no question that.
And whose turn is it this time?
Absolutely. My sister took me to see it. My mum took me to see it. My dad. Sometimes we all went to see it. Gwangi again, because I was only a young kid when I saw that on a re-release. Golden Voyage. Seventh Voyage on a re-release, because the Cyclops was incredible. And one of the first films I saw, as a kid in the cinema, was Sinbad and the Eye of the Tiger. And so a lot of people, that's kind of like seen as the lesser of the three Sinbad films.
But if you're seeing it on a movie screen rather than a TV screen,
it has a lot of value in it. There's some wonderful, wonderful things going on in that film. And I agree, perhaps it's not as complete as the other two. But there are so many great, great things, many of which are concerned with the special effects. Incredible rear projection techniques going on in it. Some amazing animation. And so there are things in Eye of the Tiger that are very much a favourite of mine. But I think it's probably Gwangi, Wumbling Years BC, Golden Voyage and Seventh Voyage. And, of course, Jason, because I saw that on TV when I was 10.
The thing about the... you've just reminded me. The thing about the exhibition, which I thought worked really well, was the demonstration of how the screens were set up.
Yep.
With the actual footage being put on the back screen to show exactly how the imagery was built up with three different layers. I thought that was fabulous.
Well, that was so important to what Ray was doing, because in the early 1950s, Ray was like, nobody could have loved King Kong more than Ray. And the way that Kong was made was very complex, because it was the layers of glass paintings with miniature scenery put in between.
Yeah.
And it worked wonderfully on the screen. It was so like it was absolutely incredible looking imagery. But Ray thought, well, I can't do this for a low budget. The early 1950s, TV was coming in. He knew how to compete with that. And low budget film producers just could not afford the time and certainly the money. Personnel, you need a whole crew of people to do that kind of thing. So Ray's process, which involved real life locations, actually photography on location or in a set, and then with a split screen to enable the model to be inserted into that. So the model, in effect, was really the only fake element in the whole thing.
Yes.
Was quick, but it looked realistic.
Yeah.
And so Ray was able to do that and convince, like, say, Beesom 20,000 Fathoms. He was able to do the whole thing with that film, and it made so much money.
Mm.
And Charles Chenier come on board, saw that movie, and wanted to contact Ray, and from that the whole relationship started, yeah. Because Chenier knew he had someone, probably, at that point, a unique person in the world,
yes.
To be able to do that kind of work so brilliantly. Yes. There was no one else,
no.
And certainly not using Ray's techniques.
Mm.
And so, yeah, that process that we in Edinburgh, they're showing that.
It's brilliant.
And you know,
really
how important that is to Ray's career, because yes. That whole process enabled Ray probably to make all the films he did.
Yeah, no, I thought that was fabulous. Again, I must reiterate, if you can go and see that exhibition, anyone who's listening in Edinburgh at the Modern Gallery of Art, I really can recommend it. So Alan, it's been great talking with you. We haven't got too technical, which is a relief, but you've given us a slight view of what a complex job it is trying to restore these objects, these objects that are now preserved, which you've helped to preserve for the future generations of movie lovers and people that maybe want to go into the film business or whatever, which is just what Ray wanted. And I just wondered if there's something that you'd like to, like a closing thing you'd like to say about Ray, which we could leave in the minds of the listeners.
Well, I did a talk about Ray a few years back, not long after he passed away, sadly, and somebody in the audience said, what was Ray's legacy? And there are two parts to it, I think. And I thought about it. I tried to think as well as I could about it. And there are two parts to this. I mean, one of the easiest sides to Ray's legacy is that he's part of a group of people, and he's not the only one. There are people like Gerry Anderson and Jim Henson and Disney and these kind of guys who let us watch things as children, and we are amazed by what we see. But then as we get older, we give up so many things as grown-ups. We have to discard parts of our childhood. It's inevitable, and we can't do anything about it. But we watch those films, we watch the Muppets, and we watch Disney films, and because they are so magical, they enable us to kind of reenact, like, go back to part of our childhood. And because of the technicality with these things that are made, because they're made by grown-ups, we can still access that. Because they're made by grown-ups, we still appreciate the technicality and the beauty with which these things are made. So that's part of Ray's legacy. But the other thing that perhaps is more personal is that we look at these films and we think, you know, how could somebody do this? This incredible work. But the truth is that Ray was just a man. He was a human being. And you think this is like the work of some sort of super-powered alien life form, but he wasn't. He was just a man. He sometimes he would get out of bed and wouldn't want to go to work, and he got fed up with things, and he was subject to frailties and insecurities like everyone else. And yet, he managed to achieve things that seem superhuman. They seem beyond belief. And it's like he's saying to us, well, you know, I did this, so why don't you do something amazing?
Believe in yourself, sort of thing.
Yeah, because he did. And, you know, look at him. You put him on a pedestal, which in many respects, from a creative point of view, you can. But he was just I met him, I knew him for 3 years. Mm. He was just some fella. We had a laugh. We talked about Lauren Hardy films, and he was such an easygoing fella. And I thought, this is a guy who did all this work, and he's just a chap.
Mm.
And I think Ray's real legacy, he's kind of like, almost like he's speaking to us, saying, well, I was some fella, but I did all this. So you could do something.
Mm.
Why don't you try it?
Live your dream.
Why don't you try it? Because if I did it and I was just flesh and blood, then you can do something amazing too with your life. And I think that's his real legacy. I think that's what he's really passing on to all of us.
created a monster today. Right, let's keep it small anyway. Right, you created a monster today. Right, will you let me see it one of these days? Is it a T-Rex? Is it a King Kong? No special effects. Is it big and strong? It's in the garage, no undercarriage. Across the ocean, a magic potion. The Harryhausens can bring joy to hundreds of thousands. Poetry in motion, right? You created a monster today. Sure it stays on the tray. Right, is it painted blue, green or grey? Just say, it won't escape any day. I get it moving, full of some motors, a bit of glue and plenty of photos. Don't tell your mother or any other, they won't believe us. A crazy notion, the Harryhausens upsetting hundreds of thousands with poetry in motion. Right, you created a monster today. Right,